Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. One summer night in Essex, England, after everyone had gone to bed, the countryside was calm and peaceful. Through the light breeze and the hot air came the sounds of bicycle tires on a gravel road. The man on the bicycle was pedaling towards his parents' brick home on an old farm road. He leaned the bicycle up against the house and went inside. He came back out and pedaled away as if nothing had happened. But something had most definitely happened. Something evil and unthinkable. This is the story of the murders at White House Farm. Let's get into it. 1985. Neville and June Bamber were living here in this beautiful and stately brick home down a country road near the village of Tolleasant Darcy in Essex, England. Neville and June were in their 60s. They had done very well for themselves and owned not only the farm, which they named White House Farm, but several other properties, including a caravan park, we call that an RV or a trailer park here in the States, and several other businesses. Earlier in their lives, Neville and June had adopted two children, Sheila and Jeremy. Sheila was born in 1957 and was 28 years old at the time. She was a very, very troubled person who was struggling with increasingly severe mental illness. She had attended Secretarial College in London, but when she was 17, she discovered she was pregnant by a man named Colin Caffell. The Bambers arranged an abortion for Sheila, but she continued seeing Colin, and later that summer, June found Sheila and Colin sunbathing naked in a field. This sent June into a rage. Seems like a bit of a strange thing to go into a rage over, two people naked in the sun. It sounds great. But after this, June started calling Sheila the devil's child. Sheila finished her secretarial training and then worked as a hairdresser for a while, where she met someone who told her she should model. She worked briefly as a model and even went to Tokyo for a time to be photographed there. But once again, she discovered she was pregnant, again by Colin, and this time they were married. They had a small ceremony at Chelmsford in May of 1977, but then Sheila had a miscarriage. The Bambers bought Sheila and Colin a small home, and 2 years later, Sheila gave birth to her twins, Nicholas and Daniel. When Sheila was 5 months pregnant with the twins, she found out Colin was cheating on her and he abandoned his family. This crisis was the first sign that Sheila was not only fragile, but unstable. She had such a breakdown that she required hospitalization. After she and Colin divorced in 1982, Sheila's mental health began to decline quite rapidly. She would have these episodes of banging her head against the walls. And in 1983, she was diagnosed with schizophrenia and began treatment with antipsychotic drugs. Sheila then became obsessed with religion and with the devil. She believed that the devil had given her power to project evil onto other people. And she believed that that evil had invaded her sons. She began claiming the young boys were trying to seduce her. And she said it was only a matter of time before they began killing people. This was a very disturbed woman. The boys' father, Colin, then took over the majority of care for the twins. But they would very often go and spend time at White House Farm with their grandparents and with Sheila whenever she was visiting her parents. Sheila was known to be violent at times. She threw things at people. She had fits of rage where she would screech in public at neighbors, and she had a very difficult time controlling herself. All that said, Sheila loved her children and was known to remain calm around them even when she was out of control around everyone else. Jeremy Bamber, the son, was born in 1961 and adopted by Neville and June when he was 6 months old. They sent him to a very good primary school and then to this boarding school, Gresham's Boarding School in Holt, Norfolk. Jeremy would later claim he was bullied and even SA'd at that school, but others who went to the school say that actually Jeremy was the bully. They say he was mean and violent with other children, and he often talked about how his parents loved his sister more than him and had dumped him off in boarding school to get rid of him. When Jeremy got out of boarding school, his father paid for him to spend time in Australia, where he learned to scuba dive, and then he spent a bit of time in New Zealand. While in New Zealand, Jeremy got into trouble for burglarizing a jewelry store and stealing a very expensive watch. He also told his friends that he was involved in smuggling drugs, but they were quite sure this was just boasting and wasn't really true. Jeremy Bamber was very fond of himself. He was a good-looking man, and he often wore a little mascara or a little eyeliner to accentuate his eyes. Nothing wrong with that, but he was vain, and he did like the women. He had lots of girls around him at all times, and he was known to kind of use and discard women. When he returned to England, his father gave him a job at the caravan park that he owned, the trailer park, managing the daily tasks there, and his father paid him quite well. It sounds to me as though Neville and June were loving parents who perhaps spoiled their children a bit, while maybe at the same time being a little strict and a bit distant from them. And as those of us who follow these cases know, that can sometimes be a dangerous combination, right? Distant parents, judgmental parents, that coldness. It can breed a lot of resentment, even when it's unintentional. In early August of 1985, Sheila and her boys arrived at White House Farm to spend the week there with Neville and June. Everything seemed quite normal, and the boys were excited to spend time with their grandparents who loved them and loved having them on the farm. A few days after Sheila and the twins got to the farm, Jeremy came to visit as well. He was living at this little cottage not too far away at the time, and again working at the family caravan park. As the family sat and ate dinner one night, Neville suggested that Sheila should put the boys in daytime foster care with a local family. This isn't a thing in America. Your kids are either in foster care or they aren't. But apparently in England, there are programs where you can place your children with families during the day to take care of them, and then the children come back home at night to be with their parents. Honestly, for parents that are struggling with mental health problems or drug addiction, that kind of sounds like a really beautiful solution. A family who's willing to take that on to help someone else who's struggling. That seems really nice. Wow, what a concept. A fantastic social program where the village helps to raise the child. We don't do that here in America. You're on your own here until it gets so bad that they take your kids away. When Neville suggested this to Sheila, they were kind of surprised that she had little reaction at the time. They had suggested this before and it had sent Sheila into a spiral, so this was a different reaction. She didn't seem upset at the thought of having her kids out of her care all day because she was really, really struggling. She was not well. Sheila did not want to lose her children, and perhaps this suggestion sounded like a relief for her, a way to keep the children, but also have some help during her struggles. The family finished dinner, and everyone felt a bit relieved, knowing that Sheila seemed to be okay with getting some help for the kids. Jeremy left around 9:30 that evening. At about 10 p.m., Neville's secretary telephoned him to inform him of something that couldn't wait until morning, and she said she was surprised that Neville was short with her and hung up on her. It's something that had never happened before. Neville was known to be a kind and very even-tempered man. So this was the first indication that maybe things hadn't gone so well that night. Maybe Sheila was really upset, and maybe trouble was on the horizon. August 6th, 1985. Sometime after dark, after everyone had gone to bed, something absolutely horrific happened there in the quiet darkness of the summer night. Inside the home at White House Farm, Neville was dead on the kitchen floor, lying near the fireplace in his pajamas. He had been shot 8 times. He had also been beaten with a blunt object. June was dead, lying on the floor by the door of her bedroom. She had crawled from her bed after being shot there and was finished off with a shot between her eyes when her killer saw that she had moved. Daniel and Nicholas were dead in their beds. Sheila was dead on the floor of her mother's bedroom. She was sitting upright in her nightgown. She had 2 bullet wounds under her chin, and in her lap was a shotgun. A call comes into the police department at Chelmsford Police Station, but it doesn't come to the 999 emergency number. It comes into the main line used for police business. On the line is Jeremy Bamber. He states that he received an alarming phone call from his father, Neville, in which Neville told him, "Sheila has gone berserk with a gun." Jeremy then claims the line went dead. He told the police he was going to drive to the farm, and the police said they would arrive shortly. As the officers drove to the farm, they caught up with Jeremy, who was driving unusually slow to the farm. So slowly, in fact, that the police ended up passing him and arriving at the farmhouse before Jeremy did. After Jeremy got to the farm, he and the three officers who'd arrived stood outside the house waiting for a tactical firearms unit to get to the scene. That unit got there around 5 a.m., but they decided to wait until daylight before trying to enter the house. This seems a very strange detail to me. You've got people inside in danger, and you're going to wait till daylight? I mean, what? Police checked the outside doors and windows and found them locked. Then they got a bullhorn and for the next 2 hours used it to call to Sheila, assuming she was on a rampage and holed up in the house and that they could communicate with her. They never got any sound from inside the house other than that of a barking dog. Police said during this time, Jeremy, who openly admitted he didn't get along with his sister, remained completely calm, at one point telling the police, "I don't really know about her. She's a nutter. She's been having treatment." The cops asked Jeremy why on earth his father would call him and not the police if Sheila was running around with a gun. And Jeremy told them that his father was the type of person who wanted to keep things like that quiet, that his parents were actually kind of embarrassed about Sheila and wouldn't want everyone to know how bad her behavior was. Jeremy also told the police, as they waited for daylight, that the family had gone shooting a few days earlier, hunting rabbits, and that he knew there were guns in the house, as well as lots of ammunition. Finally, at around 8 a.m., the police used a sledgehammer to break down the back door, and inside, they found a scene straight out of a horror film. The entire family, of course, dead. The investigating officer, Detective Inspector Ronald Cook, later recalled that at the time, the scene looked quite self-explanatory, at least to him. They believe Sheila had, in fact, gone berserk and killed her entire family and then herself. The police reports that they filed at the time reflect the fact that that's what they believe happened. The bodies were removed from the house, and the village and then the nation was shocked as word of what had happened spread. An entire family gone. Wiped off the face of the earth by someone in a fit of rage. It was almost unimaginable. The media printed stories about the massacre day after day. It was on the news and in the papers and magazines, and it was all anyone was talking about at the time. At the funeral, Jeremy appeared as a tragic figure, the only surviving member of a family that had been annihilated by a mentally ill sister, daughter, and mother. Jeremy's girlfriend, Julie Mugford, was by his side, practically holding him up as they exited the vehicle and followed the chain of caskets from inside the church to the cemetery. People rallied around Jeremy and offered him support during this time of unimaginable loss and tragedy. But unlike the police, not everyone was confident that they knew what had happened. A cousin of the Bamber family, David Boutflower, along with several family members, went to the office of Detective Chief Inspector Thomas Jones and told him they had it all wrong. David was certain that Jeremy had set this entire event up and that he was, in fact, the murderer. Chief Inspector Jones was so angry at these statements and accusations that the police were so far off course that he threw the Bamber cousins out of his office in a fit of rage. About this same time, the police entered the home at White House Farm and scrubbed the blood off of the walls and burned the bed sheets and the carpeting and cleaned up the crime scene. They later said they were trying to spare the family members the gruesome task of having to clean up after what happened. 3 days after the murders, they handed the keys of the house back to Jeremy Bamber. On that same day, one of the Bamber's cousins was going through the house under the guise of assisting Jeremy, but really looking for evidence, and he found it. There, inside a cupboard, clearly visible and completely missed by the police, was a silencer. It appeared to have blood on it, and there was also visible a long hair coming from the barrel. This cousin went to the police and told them about the silencer in the cupboard, and it took them 3 days to go and collect it. What is happening here? I know this was a while ago, but it wasn't that long ago, and they're treating this crime scene pretty casually. A few days later, family members found a large scratch along the mantelpiece above where Neville had been found, and it looked like it had been made by something metal. It had not been there before the murders, and the cousins told police they believed it was made by the tip of the silencer as Neville was beaten with the gun. Then the cousins learned that the police had not even asked to inspect Jeremy Bamber's hands, his clothing, his shoes, nothing. They had done absolutely no investigation into Jeremy Bamber whatsoever. The extended family members of the Bambers were now at odds with the police. They'd been thrown out of the police station, and the police felt they were antagonizing them and trying to make them look bad in the press. And just when it was all quite messy and getting worse, Jeremy Bamber decided to go on a vacation. But he didn't take his girlfriend Julie with him. They had had a fight over another girl that Jeremy was seeing in secret. And with Jeremy off on holiday, Julie decided it was time to start talking. September 7th, 1985. Julie Mugford arrives at the Chelmsford police station. She tells the police that not only had Jeremy killed his entire family and set it up to look like Sheila had done it, but that he had actually been planning it for a year. She claims Jeremy was always a big talker and a braggart, and she never in any way thought that he was seriously considering doing harm to his family.
It was Christmas of 84 when he first started talking about it. And he had this intention of poisoning them and burning down the house. And I just disregarded what he was saying, really, because he used to say things to shock people. And I just followed up with a comment like, don't be so ridiculous, you can't burn down the house, it's far too big and people would see it anyhow. And that's how seriously I took him at that stage. I just dismissed it as idle chit-chat, really.
Julie and Jeremy had been dating since 1983, but she had since turned on him. He had cheated on her regularly, and hey, how many murders do we know of that have been solved by a scorned partner coming forward? More than a few, right? Julie said Jeremy is a thief. She admitted to helping Jeremy steal around £1,000 from his father's caravan park in March of 1985. She claims Jeremy had staged that crime to look like a break-in, and he got away with it. Jeremy was actually arrested for that theft and taken into custody. Julie told the police that in October of 1984, Jeremy told her he, quote, wished he could get rid of them all when speaking of his family. That would leave Jeremy as the only heir to the family money, and that's what he wanted. He spoke poorly of his parents, calling them old and mad and claiming they were trying to ruin his life. He had been abusive with Julie. She also admitted that at several times she had slapped Jeremy as well, and once even held a pillow over his head, calling him a psychopath. Jeremy was angry that his parents were paying for Sheila's expensive flat, and he talked about sedating his parents with sleeping pills, shooting them, and setting fire to the farmhouse, saying Sheila would make an easy and obvious scapegoat. Then Julie gave the authorities everything they needed. She said that on the night of the murders, Jeremy dyed his hair black. He brought his mother's bicycle back to his cottage after dinner, and he told Julie that he was, quote, pissed off, and that it was tonight or never. Julie said that her phone rang around 3 a.m. and it was Jeremy on the line. He told her, everything is going well. Something is wrong at the farm. I haven't had any sleep all night. Bye, honey, and love you lots. Sheila claimed that later that morning, when she saw Jeremy with the police after the bodies were discovered, he bowed his head and came in close to her and said, I should have been an actor. Creepy and sick. But also, we got to talk about Julie here for a second. Julie probably should have come forward before now, right? Definitely should have come forward when she knew something, but I'm glad she finally did come forward. But yeah, I guess I'll just leave it at that. Julie spent a great deal of the day with the police, and the media had a frenzy watching her enter the police station and then exit it hours later. Of course, everyone was wondering what she had been talking about with police for so long and what she had told them. September 8th, 1985. Jeremy Bamber is arrested as he returns home by ship from vacation. He was charged with breaking in the Osea Bay Caravan Park on March 25th, 1985 and stealing £980. He was released on bail 4 days later. Jeremy immediately left for another vacation in Saint-Tropez, but not before trying to sell his life story, along with the naked photos of Sheila he had, to the Sun newspaper for £20,000. He's a peach, our Jeremy, right? Just a peachy, peachy peach. Jeremy was on vacation for a couple of weeks, acting as though he didn't have a care in the world. But while he was away, the Crown was building a case against him. They brought in this forensic psychiatrist who told prosecutors that the blood evidence did not match up with the murder suicide. She said there was no possible way Sheila could have committed the murders. And then we have the very obvious issues with the gun. This is a photo of the gun without the silencer. Tell me how you're going to put this long barrel under your chin and pull the trigger without the silencer. And there is forensic evidence that the silencer was on. Well, look at this photo of the gun with the silencer. You could pole vault with this thing. There is no way on earth Sheila is reaching that trigger with that thing under her chin. Absolutely no way. This, along with other evidence, is enough. And as Jeremy suns himself on the seashore, an arrest warrant is drafted. When he returns, again from vacation, he is arrested in England on September 29th at Dover and is charged with the murders of his family. His trial began on October 3rd, 1986. Hey, they don't mess around in England. That's weeks later. It would take you a year just to go to trial here in the States, right? Mr. Justice Drake headed the jury composed of 7 men and 5 women at Chelmsford Crown Court. The prosecution claimed that Jeremy was motivated by hatred for his family and, of course, by greed. It stated that he had meticulously planned the entire crime and afterwards had arranged the scene to make it appear that Sheila was the killer. The defense brought in a psychiatrist who testified that Sheila was dangerous and violent and more than capable of committing such a crime. The defense brought neighbors and townspeople to the stand who testified of Sheila's public outbursts, her obsession with the devil, the very disturbing things she had said about her own children. There was no question that Sheila was a deeply disturbed and very ill person, but was she a murderer? On October 28th, the jury said no. They found Jeremy Bamber guilty by a majority of 10 to 2 and sentenced him to 5 life sentences with a recommendation that he serve a minimum of 25 years. Later on in 1988, Home Secretary Douglas Hurd made the decision that Jeremy Bamber will never be paroled. He will remain in prison for the rest of his life. In 1989, and then again in 1994, Jeremy Bamber appealed his sentence. His attorney said the investigation was botched from the beginning. They said there was prejudice towards Jeremy from the people that didn't like him. And they even claimed that language at trial describing Jeremy was too forceful. By 2002, the appeals had made their way to the higher courts, and after going through all of the claims made by Jeremy about unfair treatment and unsound forensic practices, the courts ruled that Jeremy Bamber's conviction would stand. In 2015, a campaign was undertaken to free Jeremy. Now, why this is, I can't tell you. I don't know why people suddenly decided to take up his case and felt they needed to help this person who did such a terrible thing. Now, of course, these people cite things in the evidence, the case, the investigation. They claim the crime scene was damaged, which it was. They claim the silencer was improperly studied. And there is some validity to some of these claims. There's no question that the investigation was botched. The crime scene was contaminated. I mean, for hell's sakes, the police went in and cleaned it up just a couple days after the murders. So yes, some of these claims are valid. And they're valid enough for Jeremy to have some support and some legal footing on which to stand.
New forensic evidence has emerged that challenges the conviction of a man for one of the most notorious multiple murders of a generation, the killing of 5 members of his own family in a remote Essex farmhouse in 1985. The man convicted of those murders, Jeremy Bamber, has been pleading his innocence for 25 years. The prosecution case was that Bamber, using a silencer, had gone into the farmhouse in the dead of night, murdered his own family, including his adopted sister and her children in their sleep. His defence was that it was his sister who had a history of severe mental illness that had carried out the murders and then killed herself. During the trial, scratch marks allegedly created by the murder weapon played a key part in his conviction. Now, new evidence suggests these marks were made after the murders took place.
In this case, the scratch marks underneath the mantel shelf turned out to be the most significant bit of evidence that we came across.
The scratch marks, which were central plank to the prosecution's assertions, those scratch marks, it now appears, were not in fact made on the night of the murders and were in fact made at some point afterwards. For that reason, the significance of Mr. Souther's findings really cannot be overestimated.
The prosecution argued that a struggle had ensued between Neville Bamber and his son. This led, they said, to the silencer on the gun scratching marks on the kitchen mantel shelf. Except new photographic evidence by one of Britain's leading forensic experts shows that pictures on the day of the murder, August the 7th, show no scratch marks on the mantel shelf.
The court had believed that these scratch marks underneath the mantel shelf had taken place during the incident itself. That was something which the jury and the prosecution relied upon in order to convict Mr. Bamber of the crime. It was possible to line up all these pictures in jigsaw fashion to show that the scratch mark from the underside of the mantel shelf did not extend into the picture of the mantel shelf taken on the 7th of August, the time of the incident itself. So the marks had been put there after the original incident.
Peter Southerst found a second piece of evidence that also convinced him that the scratch mark evidence was unsigned.
I was looking for traces of paint particles which would have dropped from the mantel shelf onto the carpet below the mantel shelf, directly in front of the Arrow cooker. I looked very carefully at the carpet, and there was no evidence whatsoever of any paint particles or any wood particles or anything like that there, when I would have expected them to be there if the marks had occurred on the 7th of August.
But it's not just this new photographic evidence that Bamber's lawyers are putting forward to appeal against his conviction. They are challenging it on seven additional grounds. And they also say it's unacceptable for the police to continue to withhold documents relating to the case.
Overall, while we've worked very hard to obtain full disclosure, it is our understanding that a significant volume of evidence remains undisclosed in this case, and that is something which we have requested on several occasions, but to date we have not received full disclosure. We feel more confident than ever that there is now a real possibility that this conviction would not be upheld, and we therefore feel confident that the CCRC should now make a referral to the Court of Appeal as soon as possible.
The legal wrangling continues, and Jeremy Bamber continues to sit in jail at HM Prison Wakefield in Yorkshire. He continues to claim that his release is coming just around the corner. As you would expect, this case has inspired a series of media projects. In 2020, the biggest of those projects was released. It's a made-for-television series called The Murders at White House Farm, and it stars Freddie Fox as Jeremy. It's got a 7.4 out of 10 rating on IMDb, and it's on HBO if you'd like to watch it. When I went to watch it as part of my research for this case, I realized I had already seen the first three episodes, and I just hadn't remembered to watch the rest of it. I watch a lot of true crime, you guys, a lot of true crime. But as I skimmed through it, it came back to me. It's a solid series if you've got access to HBO and would like to watch it. And there is a book of the same name on Amazon as well. This is a tragic story about a greedy young man who had a big ego and a lazy attitude, who wanted to take the easy way through life. It's a familiar story, one that we see a lot in the true crime community, but one that never fails to shock us and to remind us that hatred and greed aren't reserved for outsiders. Sometimes the ugliest aspects of human character live in the people we know best, and those people live just down the hall from us in our own house. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you liked the video and subscribe to the channel if you'd like to see more from me. You can also join my Patreon if you'd like to support me. That is very much appreciated. And as most of you know, the end goal here is raising funds for cold case DNA storage testing. Stay safe and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.